Well, it seems to be a habitual task of mine to introduce people to you that you already know. Indeed, introducing Dr. Arthur Just is a little like introducing a brother or a father to his own family. Indeed, he has been a steadfast, even immovable fixture on this campus for, 30 years now? 1984, so 31 years. The time goes by, I guess. And in these 31 years, we have gotten to know Dr. Just rather well. He is a man of gracious disposition, very keen intellect, and perhaps best known as maybe the most stylish, best-dressed professor on the campus. Of course, given the competition, that's not saying a lot, I suppose. But his work has focused on two primary areas of interest. The first is exegetical work with the Gospel of Luke, evident in his well-known writings, The Ongoing Feast, the Concordia Commentary on Luke, and other works. And his second area of interest, of course, is work with the theology and practice of the Lutheran liturgy, demonstrated in his work with the lectionary for LSB, as well as his book, Heaven on Earth. I think personally, I first came to know Dr. Just as a student in his class, like so many, his class on the liturgy. And as a student in that class, you could not help but appreciate Dr. Just's passion for the divine service as he unpacked the theological, the Christological, the cosmological, anybody know any more logical words? The eschatological dimensions of Christ's presence on the altar. And I think I can say, and I think I can speak for many of his students, following his class, I would never partake of Christ's body and blood again in the same way. It was a truly enriching class. It was only after this class on the liturgy that I then came to learn of his passion for the Gospel of Luke. His exegetical work shows that he is not merely interested in the rational content of text, but also in the very aesthetic beauty of their form. I think Dr. Just taught many of us what a chiasm is. I'm not sure what it is anymore, but at the time, I think I was enthused about it. And so chiasms, the significance of the eighth day, the great reversal, Christianity is the way, all of these are themes that immediately come to mind when I think of Dr. Just. Indeed, I think his work embodies the very ideal of what this campus is about, namely theology as a holistic discourse, uniting exegetical, historical, systematic, and pastoral disciplines in a single doxology to Christ the Crucified. And so I'm very happy and privileged to introduce to you our guide and companion on the way to Emmaus, Dr. Arthur Just.
Boy. It's all downhill from here. And I promise no chiasms. My title is Asphalia as Canonical Criterion, trying to impress people with the Greek there. It's the last word in the prologue for those of you who don't know Greek, and it means certainty or assurance or reliability. During his third missionary journey, the Apostle Paul, like his Lord, turned his face to go to Jerusalem. As Luke the evangelist reports in Acts 19, now after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. So it was that during Paul's third missionary journey, he intended to travel to Jerusalem and Rome, and perhaps beyond that to Spain, the final destinations of his apostolic activity before returning to Rome for his martyrdom in AD 65. Luke and Paul in Philippi. But Paul's third missionary journey was not without controversy, particularly in Ephesus, where, as Luke understates in Acts 19, there arose no little stir concerning the way. resulting in a considerable company of people becoming enraged and crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," thereby filling the city with confusion. The uproar was such that it resulted in Paul's departure for Macedonia, then to Greece, where he stayed for 3 months. His intent was to sail from Greece to Syria, and then to Jerusalem, perhaps for the Passover. But some sort of plot against him by the Jews caused him to reconsider. Instead, he headed back to Macedonia, which is serendipitous, since he would not have otherwise encountered Luke in Philippi, where he celebrates the Pascha with him and the Philippian saints. Sailing away from Philippi with Luke, Paul is finally on his way to Jerusalem in time to celebrate the feast of Pentecost. Luke carefully constructs Paul's journey to Jerusalem to mirror Jesus' journey in the gospel. Perhaps Luke's care in describing Paul's journey to Jerusalem was because he was an eyewitness, this being the second of three "we" sections in Acts. But there may be more to this than a simple attribution to Luke's eyewitness account, for he describes not only the places Paul journeyed, Macedonia, Greece, Philippi, Troas, Assos, Mytilene, Chios, Samos, and Miletus, but also the delegation that accompanied him along the way: Sopater from Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, and Timothy, and the Asians Tychicus and Trophimus. He also carefully places these events within the Jewish calendar of Pascha and Pentecost. No, Paul's journey to Jerusalem and beyond to Caesarea Maritima and Rome is of special significance to Luke. Had Jesus not turned his face to go to Jerusalem, there would be no atonement. So with Paul, had he not turned his face to go to the same holy city, there would be no Gospel of Luke or Book of Acts, perhaps no Markan Gospel. Paul may later give up his life in Rome during the Neronian persecution, but he needed to be in Jerusalem for Pentecost, and even more importantly, in Caesarea for consultations with Luke and Mark for the writing of their Gospels. Luke, Mark, and Paul in Caesarea Maritima. So goes the theory of Bo Ryka in The Roots of the Synoptic Gospels, that is based on his reading of Philemon 23:24. "Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, sends greeting to you, and so do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, my fellow workers." And note that Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke were with Paul in Troas as he made his way to Jerusalem. Ryka argues persuasively that Paul penned Philemon during the 2 years of his captivity in Caesarea Maritima in AD 58 to 60, since he writes in Philemon 9 that "I, Paul, an ambassador and now a prisoner also for Christ Jesus." And during his captivity, Luke and Mark were with Paul, consulting with him in the writing of their Gospels, helping to explain the close parallels between the two, especially the sequence of pericopes. As Ryka notes, the best explanation for the parallelism is the personal contacts between the evangelists in Caesarea, which are indicated by the Pauline captivity epistles. So what seemed like an unfortunate inconvenience for Paul, not sailing directly to Palestine from Greece, and instead traveling through Greece to Macedonia and beyond that to Troas and Miletus, allowed Paul to reunite himself with Luke in Philippi and celebrate the Pascha there, and beyond that to Jerusalem and Caesarea and the writing of a gospel. Not many have questioned what Luke may have been up to between the first "we" sections of Acts during Paul's second missionary journey, when Paul received the Macedonian call to come to Europe to preach the gospel in AD 51, and this serendipitous reunion with Paul at the end of his third missionary journey as he makes his way to Jerusalem 7 years later. What was Luke doing for those 7 years? And is it simply a coincidence that Paul leaves him in Philippi in AD 51 and then reunites with him in Philippi 7 years later? Could it be that Luke was the pastor of Philippi for those 7 years? Could Luke have been the bishop of Macedonia, overseeing the distribution to the house churches of the few New Testament documents available at that time, especially the Gospel of Matthew, as well as overseeing their Eucharistic life? Could Luke's pastoring of Philippi be the reason why this congregation is the one most beloved by Paul, the most faithful of all the churches he founded, and perhaps the most generous? Could Paul's letter to the Philippians be the last letter he wrote from Rome while under house arrest, as recorded at the end of Acts? A love letter to them for their fidelity and liberality, his farewell before his unexpected release and subsequent mission to Spain, followed by his return to Rome for that martyrdom in AD 65. Remarkably, few commentators wonder what Luke was up to for those 7 years. Typical of such lack of curiosity is Colin Hemer in his monumental book, The Book of Acts in its setting of Hellenistic history, who, in commenting on the person of Luke himself, his personality, notes that he first appears in Acts 16:10 at Troas, is lost to view at Philippi, and reappears there in chapter 20 of Acts, verse 5. But Philip Carrington, a reliable and infinitely readable historian of the first century, assumes that Luke was the pastor when he asks, after Paul and Luke celebrated the Pascha in Philippi, who was put in charge of the church at Philippi when Luke left it? And C.K. Barrett, Durham theologian, in the introduction to his second volume on the commentary of the book of Acts, asks, did he, Luke, when Paul moved on, remain in Philippi? Had the first person been in Philippi all this time? But it is Bo Ryka, in his book Reexamining Paul's Letters, The History of the Pauline Correspondence, who is the most explicit about Luke's role in Philippi as he comments on the careful details of the beginning of Paul's journey to Rome. Reike writes, by using the we form, the author apparently wanted to show that he also experienced the events in Macedonia and was explicitly included in the work of spreading the gospel. Moreover, it is striking that the very next we passage is Paul's and his companions' final departure from Philippi, and that both occurrences, though separated by considerable distance in time and events, are recorded with such meticulous detail. Acts 16 and Acts 20, God had called us to preach the gospel, but we set sail after the days of unleavened bread. The precise descriptions in these two passages, as well as their association with Philippi, imply that the author was active in Macedonia, at least in part, during the time that Paul worked in Athens, Corinth, and Ephesus. Thus, the coincidence between the first and second we passages might well be because of the author's special association with Philippi and the Pauline Macedonian mission. The "we" suggests that Luke was active as a preacher in Philippi and Macedonia, although he wanted to remain anonymous in the company of Paul, Timothy, and Silas. In summary, the following chart on the "we" sections of Acts suggests that Luke pastored Philippi and other congregations in Macedonia for 7 years. There in the first of the "we" sections in Acts 16, 10 to 7, during the second missionary journey, where Paul in AD 51 has the Macedonian vision and first comes to Philippi. And then the question is this: did Paul spend this intervening time in Philippi as their pastor? There's the second "we" section, Acts 25 to 21, 18, during the third missionary journey, where they had the Pascha in Philippi, the incident in Troas with Eutychus, and then from Troas to Jerusalem. The final "we" section, which I really don't deal with, but just so that you can see all three, is the end of Acts 27:1 to 28:16 in the journey to Rome, where they wintered in Cyprus, the storm at the sea, the shipwreck, the safe harbor in Malta, and of course the Roman imprisonment. Theophilus. But there is one more thing to consider about Luke and Paul in Philippi. Could Theophilus be a catechumen from the church in Philippi? A wealthy man who offered to serve as a literary patron of Luke's gospel during that celebration of the Pascha in AD 58, the most excellent Theophilus, to whom Luke dedicates both the gospel and Acts. Could this Theophilus be like many Gentiles who were yearning for a gospel to be written for them? Assuming Matthean priority, could Theophilus, a Gentile, have been listening to Luke preach on Matthew for 7 years, and he is now willing to fund a gospel in his own language, so to speak, a gospel for him, a Gentile, a Roman citizen, to hear the Jesus story from a Hellenistic point of view? Matthew's gospel was reliable and certain, but Theophilus desired a gospel for him and people like him, one that is Pauline, written now at the end of Paul's missionary journeys, written for the churches Paul had founded among the Gentiles in both Asia Minor and Europe. The danger of a new gospel is that it would be measured against the certainty of Matthew's gospel, with all its Jerusalem and Jewish gravity. Could Luke measure up? Could Theophilus and the Gentiles in Philippi be certain that Luke's gospel could serve as a catechesis for Gentiles, as Matthew's gospel had served as catechesis for Jews, and then later on for Gentiles like Theophilus? Would Jerusalem approve? And could the Jesus story be told from another point of view, a Hellenistic one? And could it be told from a Pauline perspective? What Theophilus may wonder about as he reads Luke's gospel is whether it is canonical, as Matthew's gospel is canonical, whatever that might mean. Could the purpose of Luke's prologue to his gospel, addressed to most excellent Theophilus, be to affirm that his gospel was as reliable as Matthew's, and that the oral and written traditions that Luke used to compile his gospel were as faithful and true to the gospel as to the gospel story as Matthew's? Could the prologue's final word, asphalia, certainty, reliability, truth, be a criterion for canonicity? For that is how Luke ends his prologue, a periodic sentence ending with this purpose clause: in order that you come to recognize completely the certainty of the story through which you have been catechized. Asphalia in the Lucan prologue. Whether Theophilus is a catechumen from the Philippi congregation or not is not crucial to a consideration of Asphalia as criterion for canonicity. What Theophilus is not is some archetypal lover of God, although I agree with my colleague Peter Scare that this suggests that all of us, in a sense, as we read the Gospels, are lovers of God. We're all Theophiluses. But it is Origen who made the designation that Theophilus should be lover of God, and later by Ambrose, who used Origen's commentary on Luke for his own commentary. Theophilus is a real person in the first century, a literary patron, a God-fearer, who has been catechized by Jewish materials, Matthew, but is now encouraging Luke to write a gospel for the catechesis of Gentiles by Jewish Christians. Living in the historical context of the first century, he is a Gentile seeking certainty in a Gentile way from Luke and Paul. Speculation about the identity of Theophilus makes for fascinating reading, but it is probably impossible to determine who he is, although he appears to be a catechumen. And since the word katexethes, catechesis, is used in the prologue, and why not from Philippi? But Theophilus and Gentiles like him are not the only ones searching for certainty in the words through which they have been catechized. One of our guest speakers, our good colleague from St. Louis, Dr. Jeffrey Kloa, in the final paragraph of his article, Theological Hermeneutics After Meaning, states, "For what we crave is certainty, a clear word that solves all problems definitively, so that we can put this behind us and get on to whatever we think really matters. We live after meaning, that is, after meaning himself came into the flesh, died, and rose. In his work is certainty for salvation. Our lives filled with uncertainty are lived by faith, hearing ever again the voice of the shepherd and following where he leads. The need for certainty is a recurrent theme among our students, among our parishioners, and it is one that is worthy of our attention." Dr. Kloa's article refers to the incarnation and the work of Christ as the source of our certainty. Unfortunately, as the last paragraph in his essay, we do not see how he might develop this. But what he does is he puts the issue of certainty before us. And when you read all the literature about this, the problem with certainty is the uncertainty of what certainty, asphalia, means. By concluding his prologue, a periodic sentence with a purpose clause that ends with the word certainty, in the emphatic position, Luke is telling Theophilus and us that certainty matters. Asphalia may be translated as truth, reliability, assurance, guarantee, firmness, confidence. Certainty of faith is the goal of Luke's gospel, which comes from accurate, systematic instruction in the events in the narrative Luke is about to tell us. Certainty is in the story of Jesus. Or as Kloa put it, in his work is certainty for salvation. And his work for salvation is told in the gospel of Luke, a work of preaching and teaching, a work of miracles, a work of passion and resurrection and ascension. By ending with asphalia, certainty, Luke tells us that faith's certainty is why he is writing his gospel, and that his narrative is to be understood as a kerygmatic one, which is what katexethes, catechesis, implies in this context. That is, testimony regarding historical facts and proclamation of their doctrinal significance that creates faith's certainty. What certainty means for Theophilus in AD 60, I believe, is what certainty means for us in the year 2015. Certainty is not dependent on our human context. Even though Theophilus's human context was radically different from our own modern, postmodern context. We may hear differently, but Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever, as Barnabas wrote in Hebrews. I go with it. The goal of our exegesis, of Luke's goal, is to hear faith's certainty as Theophilus heard it. But how do we do that? And what was the certainty that Theophilus sought? Historical, factual certainty, theological certainty, Eucharistic certainty? What was the certainty Theophilus was seeking? H.D. Cadbury, one of the first guys to really get Lucan things going in 1921, he wrote this, suggested that asphalia is apologetic. That is, and these are his words, to defend Christians against unfavorable reports which had come to the ears of Theophilus. End of quote. Although most agree there is an apologetic character to some of Luke's material, as there is with Matthew and Mark, for example, Matthew's apologia for the sealing of the tomb with a court order, most see a more ecclesial purpose for all the Gospels. One of the commentators I was very dependent on from his PhD thesis, Daryl Bach, whose commentary on Luke came out after I wrote on Luke, he seems to agree with this, stating forthrightly that asphalia is, quote, not of a political nature, nor is Luke writing an apology to a Roman official, unquote. He suggests that, and these are his words, assurance, asphalia, is of a religious, theological nature. But then he seems to accent the historical and apologetical sense of Luke's intentions. Here are his words. Theophilus's question would seem to be, is Christianity what I believed it to be, a religion sent from God? Perhaps such a doubt resulted from the judgment the church suffered, especially as a result of including Gentiles. Why should a Gentile suffer frustration for joining what was originally a Jewish movement? Is the church suffering God's judgment because it has been too generous with God's salvation? Will the rest of God's promises come to pass? Has most of Israel rejected the promise? Can one really be sure Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise and that he brings God's salvation both now and in the future? By the emphasis on fulfillment in Jesus and the truthful character of the tradition, Luke intends to answer these questions with a resounding yes. The gospel of Jesus is from God and is available for all, Jew and Gentile alike. Here's the question. Did Luke need to give assurance to Theophilus because of the troubles Christianity caused in many of the places where it was planted? Perhaps. There are numerous moments in Acts where Luke notes the turmoil Christianity causes. For example, just before Luke and Paul's reunion in Philippi, there is the incident in Ephesus with Demetrius the silversmith, where Luke notes that about that time there was no little stir concerning the way. That's in Acts 19, verse 23. But again, the question, was Theophilus concerned with the legitimacy of Christianity as the fulfillment of God's promise, especially in light of the Jewish rejection of Christianity, and did that involve the truthful character of the tradition? So, is Luke's purpose to be accurate? That's from his prologue, Akrobos, as he suggests when he says, it seems good to me also after investigating from the beginning every tradition carefully. There's Akrobos, accurately. Is his goal truthfulness about the events, the facts? Another commentator I used back in the 90s was, I think it's Robert Stein. Here are his words. One major purpose of Luke was to assure his readers of the truthfulness of that which they had been taught about Jesus' life and teachings. Since Luke also expected his account would agree with what his readers had been taught, he anticipated that as they read his orderly account, they would come to a greater assurance of the truthfulness of this material. The purpose of Luke's prologue depends how one understands asphalia. Does it mean truth, or reliability, or assurance, or certainty, or all of the above? To translate it as reliability, as I did in the early 1990s, implied reliability in the sense of faith certainty and assurance, which is the goal of the gospel and the goal of catechesis. Asphalia means reliability in the truth of fact-telling. Let me repeat that. Asphalia means reliability in the truth of fact-telling, but implies more than that, including a sense of certainty in both the theological significance of the narrative and its certainty as a sacred text for preaching. Certainty, as I would now translate asphalia, is the certainty of faith. This is the certainty that Luke's gospel is canonical. That is, that it is both reliable in its truth-telling of the facts, but even more, that it serves the same purpose as Matthew's gospel. Namely, it is reliable and certain for preaching. Does Theophilus have certainty that Luke's narrative, diegesin, can be used for preaching in the context of the Eucharistic liturgy? As Theophilus listens to each part of the gospel narrative, he also knows the end of the story. He knows the facts about Jesus, his teaching, his rejection, and his vindication. He knows them from Matthew's gospel. And in hearing the facts of the gospel from Luke, will he be certain that they are true and worthy of preaching as a prelude to his reception of the Eucharist? But Theophilus will also hear the theological significance of these events as they are interpreted by the evangelist Luke, a catechist who knows their meaning for salvation history and who has been preaching towards the Eucharist for 7 years in Philippi. So the prologue instructs hearers of all times to seek to discover the theological significance of the events that are about to be narrated as they prepare to receive the body and blood of Christ. Asphalia, in the context of Luke's prologue again, Luke's gospel, and the book of Acts. What may help us to get at the heart of what asphalia means is this question. Is Luke's gospel worthy of Eucharistic preaching? This suggests that the meaning of asphalia cannot be determined without considering it in the context of Luke's prologue, Luke's gospel, the book of Acts, and in the ecclesial context in which Luke was writing. The slide here now is the prologue, and I've highlighted some of the words I'm going to be talking about. Certainty, you can see it's the last word there in purple. Certainty is related to Luke's description of his gospel as a narrative, diegesis, placing it into a literary category that was a familiar genre in the first century, subject to literary analysis. A story that needed to be handed down through catechesis and preaching. Certainty for Theophilus also concerns the words, logon. He has been catechized. thereby framing Luke's prologue with two different ways of speaking of the genre of his work: narrative, diegesis, and words, logon. This is the source of all preaching and catechesis. It is about events, pragmaton, that are now handed down, traditioned, paredosan, through words, logon, by eyewitnesses who became ministers of the word. And you can see that expression there, huperete, there in verse 2, that ends with, with the words genomenoi tu logu, that is, ministers of the word. So they begin as eyewitnesses who became ministers of the word, that is, ministers of the gospel narratives. Now, these are the same people, but on either side of the kerygmatic events of crucifixion, resurrection, ascension, and post-Pentecost Eucharists. This gospel narrative is the viva vox Jesu, embodied in the church's Eucharistic liturgy. For Luke, then, the word is living in the flesh of Jesus, who spoke to these eyewitnesses before he ascended, and continues to speak through them as ministers of the word in the preaching of the word, the viva vox Jesu. These ministers of the word are as much a part of the kerygma as the events that have come to fulfillment. And they became ministers of the word when, after the resurrection, Christ opened up the scriptures to them and made the events of his life, death, and resurrection the core of mission proclamation. As a kerygmatic narrative, Luke's gospel is a theological presentation of the events of the life of Jesus of Nazareth that bring to fulfillment God's plan revealed in the great Hebrew literary work, the Old Testament. Theophilus will listen to Luke's gospel to hear how Jesus fulfills the Old Testament, and he will not be disappointed. This is especially true in the Lucan frame of, this is sort of a chiasm, the Lucan frame of Jesus' preaching. First in the synagogue of Nazareth, where he cites the messianic program of Isaiah 61 and 58 and proclaims, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your ears." That's Luke 4, 16 to 30. Then at Emmaus, where beginning from Moses and from all the prophets, he, the risen Christ, explained to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. That's Luke 24, 13 to 35, the Emmaus story. And finally, to the 11, where he opens their minds to understand the scriptures, namely, that it is necessary that all the things that have been written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me be fulfilled. Jesus' final words there in 24, 44 to 49. This demonstration by Jesus of how to frame the events of his life as fulfillment of the Old Testament is the source of all apostolic preaching. For example, Peter's temple sermon in Acts 3 and Paul's homily before Agrippa in Acts 26. As Richard Dillon says, another person I used in another book for my work on Emmaus and in the commentary, but Richard Dillon, I'm citing now from an article by him entitled Previewing Luke's Project, Luke 1, 1 to 4, the prologue. As he says, these unmistakably declare the risen Lord himself to be the speaker of the mission kerygma, end of quote. If this is Luke's intent, then certainty cannot be separated from how the gospel narrative is embodied in apostolic preaching, a certainty only Luke can give with a two-volume work of dominical teaching and apostolic preaching. Now, I'm going to quote Dillon extensively here because he says it better than I can. First, he says, obviously, a story which fully told how Jesus' own words of instruction were committed to appointed witnesses, Luke 24, could effectively instill a catechumen's asphalia logon. But a story which went on to document how those witnesses actually echoed the master's speech in founding churches could instill it incomparably better. This is already an indication that the concept of Luke's two-volume opus might well be contained within the objective stated by the gospel's prologue. Luke provides programmatic affirmation of this at the beginning of Acts, at the climax of Peter's Pentecost sermon in Acts 2:36. For me, the only other significant parallel use of a derivative of asphalia to Luke's use of the word in the prologue. Again, here's Dylan. The Pentecost sermon of Peter illustrates this point with specific reference to the word asphalia. At the climax of these inaugural logoi of the mission, to which he called all Israel's attention, Acts 2:22, Peter invites a secure confession with the adverbial form of the same word. Let all Israel know with certainty, asphalos, that God has made both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you have crucified, Acts 2:36. And you know that sermon, that is the climax. This secure acknowledgement is the expected conclusion to the whole sketch of the pragmata of Jesus, beginning with his public ministrations and including his death, resurrection, and exaltation. But these are proclaimed with citation of the scriptural prophecies which declared the divine plan into which they fall. The proclamation thus continues the Easter discourse of the risen Lord, who explained the meaning of this ministry from the prophetic scriptures, Luke 24. Peter's words were aimed at a certainty of God's action, God has made, etc., which would lead in turn to the repentance and conversion called for in his peroration in Acts 2:37 and 38. The asphalia he induces in his hearers is not the assurance that things really happened as they were told, but that the events as told fall into God's plan of salvation, hence are truly saving events to which each listener must respond. Now, the only thing I would really kind of correct there is that I think they were as they really happened as they were told, but he's making a point that it's in the proclamation, and that's well taken, I think. Finally, certainty in recognizing Jesus, epigenos, in the breaking of the bread. The project, my project, of the ongoing feast, Table Fellowship and Eschatology at Emmaus, was to demonstrate that teaching and healing, word and meal, logon and pragmaton, go together, and that these two structures form the foundation for apostolic liturgy that has been handed down to us today. What we have dealt with so far is the meaning and content of logon as diegesin, gospel narrative. Together, they form the core of what becomes the liturgy of the catechumens. And for this, there is certainty, asphalia. In almost every analysis of Luke's prologue, every word is dissected and exegeted as to its theological significance, except for one word, the verb of the final purpose clause, epigenos, to recognize completely. The question the prologue begs is, how does Theophilus come to recognize completely that the words through which he has been catechized are certain? That recognition is the recognition of faith's certainty, and that recognition that Jesus is the crucified and risen Christ first happens for a human being by sight and by faith in the final chapter of Luke's gospel, where he uses the same word for recognition in describing what the Emmaus disciples experience when their eyes are opened in the breaking of the bread and they recognize him. Epignoson auton. Remarkably, very, very few, if any, commentators note and comment on Luke's use of the same word in his prologue and in the climax of Luke's gospel. In this context, recognize, epignosko, is one of Luke's many synonyms for faith and its certainty in the reliability of Christian catechesis. The Emmaus disciples may have known the historical facts about Jesus' passion and resurrection. They relate them in Luke 24, 18 to 24. But they do not understand the meaning of those facts, which they clearly indicate because Jesus chastises them for not believing, you know, in the words of the Old Testament. The goal of Jesus' catechesis and of the Emmaus narrative is for the hearer to believe in all the things that the prophet spoke. There it is, 24:25. At the beginning of the story, in Luke 24:16, the Emmaus story, the disciples' eyes were kept by God from perceiving Jesus. That's a theological passive, I think. God did it. At the end of the story, the veil is taken away. Faith's certainty, asphalia, comes only when Christ interprets the passion and resurrection facts and reveals himself in the breaking of the bread. Although the meaning of pragmaton is clearly the events of Jesus' life, especially the passion and resurrection facts, as they are described by Jesus in Luke 24, these events are also given to believers in the breaking of the bread, in body broken and blood poured out. One of the ironies and truths of the Emmaus story is that Jesus' catechesis on the road to Emmaus created burning hearts, but his logoi on the way failed to open their eyes. It was only in the breaking of the bread that their eyes were opened and they recognized him. So to return to Theophilus and the question of whether asphalia is a criterion for canonicity, as Theophilus attends the first Eucharist in which Luke's gospel is read and preached upon, would he come to the table with a burning heart, knowing and believing that he had heard the living voice of Jesus in Luke's gospel narrative, and that this had prepared him to recognize completely the risen Christ in the breaking of the bread? In this, Theophilus and all believers who follow him can be certain. Word and miracle, word and meal, word and event are the means for mission and the source of faith's certainty. Thank you.
We've got about 10 minutes or so. If anyone has any questions, feel free to come forward and ask away.
I'll just mention, maybe if anyone has questions for either Dr. Just or Dr. Scare, because there wasn't a lot of time before chapel, just feel free to come forward and ask those questions.
Uh, I thought there was just a lot of certainty out there. But.
Hello, Dr. Just. Christopher Berger, Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, South Carolina. You were asking questions that seemed to go somewhere at the very beginning about Luke's purpose in writing, and it seemed like it was in Philippi that he was writing the gospel, you assume?
No.
You think?
No, I don't know that it was in Philippi, maybe. Okay. I think that's where he connected with Paul and the conversation began about a Gentile gospel that he might pen.
And perhaps then back when they traveled back to Jerusalem?
Yeah, they traveled back to Jerusalem, and then they were in Caesarea Maritima, I think. That was the point of my opening, where Mark was too, where they sat down and kind of, you know, I mean, that's the Rika theory, that they sort of carved it up and that the Gospels were written simultaneously. He even puts Matthew in there, but I would put Matthew earlier. But yeah, no, that's the Rika theory. And it makes a lot of sense. That's why I presented it as such. Where he wrote it from, it's hard to say. Maybe Antioch. Maybe he went back to Philippi. I mean, one of the points was just to suggest maybe that Theophilus is a real person, a catechumen, he's a literary patron. Maybe he was from Philippi. I mean, he was with Paul perhaps for 7 years, and they hatched this together. You know how it is. You and your buddies sit around, drink a few beers, talk about, you know, what you're going to do. 7 years is a long time to think about these things. And it just happens that Paul comes back there and Luke joins him and they travel together. I mean, that's sort of the Rika theory, and I find it very appealing.
With the brackets on Luke with this knowing, recognizing, is my question really is the flow of Luke's and Acts. Luke and Acts is, do you see Acts is in the mind of Luke when he sits down to write the gospel?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And I think, I mean, that quotation from Dylan really put that there, that, I mean, you can see already. And I mean, one of the main points I think that Dylan makes, and I wholeheartedly approve it, is that, I mean, the certainty is in the proclamation as well as the events that are recorded. And the fact that a catechumen like Theophilus would see that it's not just the gospel, but the fact that the apostles preach that kerygma. There's the first leg of the certainty. I mean, one of the things that just amazed me, and I looked really hard for people to comment, even Dylan doesn't as much, on the use of that word, epigenosko, in the prologue and then at the end. I mean, maybe it's just because I think of that as the climax of the gospel, the opening of the eyes. But I'm just astounded nobody really picks up on that. And I looked really hard. I mean, I wanted support. Yes, sir.
Very good. In light of Galatians 3, does it make sense? Do we even need a Gentile gospel or a Jewish gospel? Don't we just need the gospel? I mean, what he's saying in terms of baptism, it seems that it's saying the gospel is not tied to particular cultural slants.
Well, I mean, maybe that's theoretically true, but the reality is we have four of them.
Yes. But
and I think that they're clearly, I think context does matter. I think audience does matter. I think the Gospels are shaped in a particular way. I mean, one of the things that we did years ago, a number of us here on the faculty, particularly Dr. Scare and Dr. Weinrich and I, we thought of the Gospels in association with the mission of the church. So Matthew was for the Jewish mission, and then Mark and Luke especially for the Gentile mission, and that these were written because they were missional documents as much as anything. And I think that still resonates with me. I think that there's a real reason for seeing the church needing to write gospels to apply to the various missional contexts in which they were finding themselves in that first century.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
This might be a little afield, but you were talking about the certainty in one of the questions that was trying to be answered by Theophilus, that Luke was trying to answer, was the certainty of that the gospel is for Gentiles. And just in light of Epiphany, can you give any insight on perhaps why the account of the Magi is not included into Luke's gospel? It's such a, I mean, it seems like that would answer so definitively that here even Gentiles are included in the beginning.
It had already been written. And you know, I mean, if you put that story in the Lucan infancy narrative, it would ruin it. I mean, because it's so beautifully constructed as it is, I don't know how you'd fit that in. But I mean, I think that story was known already in Matthew. So, Dr. Kloa.
Yeah, thanks. Very creative and persuasive paper. It was a lot of fun, actually. And I'm really struck. I never noticed this. I read too much Paul, I think, and not enough Luke, maybe. But the epigenosko auton in chapter 24, and the parallel with in chapter 1. Even grammatically, right? So they recognized him, epigenosko, right, auton. Yeah. And then in chapter 1, recognize tenos phileon, right? So the certainty is actually Christ.
That's right.
Yeah. It's brilliant.
In word and meal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure you're right about, you know, Luke being a commentary on Matthew or something. It's irrelevant. What's, I think, key in what you're arguing is Luke doesn't feel the need to defend Matthew or whatever. He doesn't need to say, right, look, Jesus really did this.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, kind of, I'm going to make
right.
an argument. He simply proclaims the work of Christ.
Right, right, exactly.
And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, because we sometimes see the four Gospels as a problem. Oh, they don't agree, and so we can't have certainty. Yeah. Well, no, it's simply the proclamation of Christ. It's in his work that there's certainty.
Right. Oh, that's
And we let it stand and we proclaim it, and this is what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 15. He just proclaims it.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. That's a great summary of what I was trying to say.
Thanks. I really appreciate your.
Yeah, I will end with a chiasm. In that verse where they recognized him, there is a chiasm, and it's auton kai autos, and he became invisible. And so right there in the center of that verse is Jesus auton, which is the kind of the word that is used after he's introduced the name Jesus in Emmaus. It's autos, auton, I mean, it's various, that's the word for Jesus. And at that moment, when they recognize him, and he immediately becomes invisible from them. There it is right in the center. And that is the climax of the gospel, and there's the certainty. In the words on the road, and in the breaking of the bread.
All right, let's show our appreciation one more time.